The following sermon was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church in Montville, New Jersey, during the 2008 Pastors Conference. The preacher is Pastor Ted Donnelly from Trinity Reformed Presbyterian Church in Newtown Abbey, Northern Ireland. The title of the sermon is The Ministerial Friendships of the Man of God.
I apologize, man, for some hoarseness of throat. I'll be taking some water on board during the address. I think it won't be a problem. I hope not. My subject, the ministerial friendships of the man of God. I open with two quotations on friendship, and according to which one you prefer, you will know whether you're a high-class, cultured individual or not. Shakespeare says, "I count myself in nothing else so happy as in a soul remembering my good friends." A sign outside a pizza restaurant says, "Friends are the bacon bits in the salad bowl of life." Friendship was a huge subject in classical times. Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero all wrote full-length treatises on the subject of friendship. It was something to which the ancients gave great attention. And for 1,500 years in Europe, schoolboys were set to translate Cicero's treatise, De Amicitia, about friendship. Friendship was celebrated in the Middle Ages and in pre-modern literature. And yet today, friendship, especially same-sex friendship, has fallen on evil days. In spite of television programs called Friends, there are fewer friendships than ever. C.S. Lewis, a generation ago, and as always, Lewis is a mixture, but he's much that is helpful. In his book, The Four Loves, has a chapter on friendship. He writes, "To the ancients, friendship seemed the happiest and most fully human of all loves, the crown of life and the school of virtue. The modern world, in comparison, ignores it." So we want to think first about the lack of friends. And it is especially true of ministers of the gospel. There's a paradox here. Ministers are public men. We have more acquaintances than most people do. We know hundreds of people. And yet ministers have fewer friends. A 2006 survey suggested that 25% of Americans have no close friends. But a survey slightly before that came up with the shocking statistic that 70% of pastors have no close friends. Now, we take these statistics with a pinch of salt, but at least there is the outline of a problem there. The men who most need friends seem to be the most lonely. Why should that be? There are a number of reasons. The basic one, of course, is that sin, ever since the Garden of Eden, alienates us from one another. So we see Adam and Eve ashamed before each other, estranged, blame-shifting, casting responsibility on the other. That is still in all of our hearts. Sin is an isolating thing. Hell is an inexpressibly lonely place. There is the fact that much of our work is done alone, of necessity. For many men, there is the camaraderie of the workplace, where together each day they're involved in various pursuits. Friendships develop, which are then continued outside the workplace. Some of the richest and most meaningful of friendships. We simply don't have the opportunity to develop these friendships. There is the misconception, contrary to the example of our Lord, that the pastor can have no special friends in the congregation. Our Lord had his three. They were his special friends. The other disciples did not take it amiss, so far as we know. It was recognized as a fact. But men are frightened by that. There are the men who say, "My wife is the only friend I need." Now, there is an element of truth in that, as we have heard in the previous hour. Our wives are incomparably our best friends. Our wives are our friends, compared to whom the rest of humanity is as the dust in the balance, supreme and unchallengeable. But our wives were not designed by God to fill all our needs as men for friendships. There are certain burdens which, if we are wise, we do not want to impose on our lives. There are aspects of our manhood which our wives do not satisfy. I don't really particularly want to sit and watch a game of rugby with my wife and discuss the interests of forward play. I would rather do it with someone else. We cannot expect more of our wives than they are designed and intended to give. Your wife, in that sense, is not meant to be your buddy. The spread of poisonous, high-profile homosexuality has, without realizing it, affected our minds, so that in society, close same-sex friendships now have a cloud of suspicion hanging over them. It has poisoned what is good. The same, of course, is true for the relationship between adults and children. I remember my grandfather, after his retirement, a saint of God. He used to buy bags of sweets and go out walking in the streets, and he would stop children and give them sweets. He would be in prison now. So sin poisons that which is pure and good and natural. The individualism of Western culture has created a false view of strong masculinity. The Marlborough man with his pony and his cigarette and nothing more. The tough he-man who needs no one and nothing but himself. And all these factors and more conspire to leave pastors isolated. What are the results of this ministerial isolation? Ecclesiastes 4 is a telling and helpful passage in this regard. The early part of the passage shows us the vanity of the isolated man. He is so caught up with business, with greed, with ambition, that he exists for himself alone. He doesn't want to share his profits. He doesn't want to share his life. A sort of a Howard Hughes type of figure. Verse 7. One person who has no other, either son or brother. Yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches. Against this, the wise man sets in verses 9 to 12 the classic "two are better than one" passage. And he shows in those verses how friendship heals the damage caused by aloneness. The isolated man may be ineffective. Yet the writer says, two have a good reward for their toil. They're not ineffective. The isolated man may become discouraged and vulnerable. And yet when there are two, if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. The isolated man will find his humanity frozen. For how can one keep warm alone? And yet, and he's thinking here of travellers in the open, in the cold Palestinian night, as darkness falls, and naturally they lie together. And if two lie together, they keep warm. And the fact that we can hardly read that verse without a knowing snigger shows how corrupted our culture has become. The isolated man may be defeated, and yet, though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. So these are the benefits of friendship. To be friendless is to risk ineffectiveness, discouragement, distortion of personality, and even catastrophic defeat. And it would be an interesting study to ask how many pastoral disasters are comprehended here. Major disasters and minor disasters. We have all seen these disasters over the years. Had those men good friends? Or had they isolated themselves and placed themselves in position of danger? We need friends. We need friends as ministers. But what is a friend? Let us look briefly at the three biblical levels of friendship. The word is used on three levels in the Bible, and these are not separated, they're cumulative. They build the one upon the other, so that the closest friend is one where all three elements are present. At the lowest level, there is association. The people we meet, the people we know slightly. We greet them in the street or at the grocery store. We spend a little bit of time with them. We feel goodwill towards them. They are not our enemies. There's not much more than that. People with whom we are in regular or infrequent casual association. The master of the vineyard says to the labourer, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Our Lord, and how we could reflect on his use of the word, says to Judas Iscariot in Gethsemane, friend. What a word. Friend, do what you came for. Association. The second level is one of allegiance. Much more than association. There's a commitment. There's a commitment of loyalty. And often, and this is interesting, it's the commitment of an inferior to a superior, of a lower to a higher, of a younger man to an older man, of a one-talent man to a five-talent man. So we read, and I'm not giving the references because you have them in your outline, we read in 2 Samuel that Hushai was David's friend. And whatever his personal relationship may have been, I don't think the writer's dealing with that. He's saying he was his ally. He was his supporter. He was loyal to him. In 1 Kings 4, Zahud the son of Nathan was the priest and the king's friend. And of course, the classic usage of this word is that barbed, intelligent comment of the chief priests and Pharisees to Pontius Pilate, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend." It was his loyalty to Caesar that they were calling into question. Caesar probably had never met the man, but he was someone who was pledged to be the friend of Caesar. So there's association, there's allegiance, and then thirdly, there is affection. The classic example of this, of course, is David and Jonathan. 1 Samuel 18, "Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul." What an intensely powerful expression. And you remember David's lament when his friend died, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary." That's the friendship of deep affection. We read in the New Testament of the disciple whom Jesus loved. There was a special bond of affection. Paul can write to the Philippians, "My brothers, whom I love and long for." Now, brethren, all these levels of friendship are valuable, and they all merit a place in the range of our relationships. But I want to focus this morning on the deepest, that which embraces all three of these levels: association, affection, and allegiance. And especially between ministers of the gospel. At present, I am blessed to have 6 close ministerial friends. One of them is 10 years older than myself. One of them 2 or 3 years older. 2 are contemporaries. 1 is 20 years younger. And 1 is 30 years younger. Not in order, but they've been friends. 1 for 45 years. 1 for 36 years. 1 for 20 years. 2 developing in the last 10 years, in the last 5 years, and 1 for 10 years. And they're all different. They're all different. They're not equally close. They have different shadings and different colorings. Each of those friends gives me something different, and I give them something different. There's a rich variety in them. It's a wonderful thing. And yet they're all relationships of association and allegiance and affection. And among these friendships is my friendship with Al Martin. He in turn has many friendships. He in turn has a few very close friendships. And to do what George did earlier, let me quote, and it's almost the same passage, from the letter we received when we were asked to speak. "Something about Pastor Martin's life or ministry that has made a significant impact upon you, or that you believe is a notable characteristic of him and his ministry." Like George, many possibilities came to mind. Some of them my brethren are dealing with. But I thought at once, above all, of what his friendship has meant to me. Ministerial friendship. Of what I have seen his friendship meaning to others, and what our friendship has meant to him. And to me, he is an outstanding example of ministerial friendship. I believe he is a man who has a genius for friendship. So that's the subject I want to take this morning. His friendship with me is very precious. It is also private. And I've always felt a certain contempt for those who were quick to parade their friendship with those more eminent than themselves. It seems to me cheap and corrupting and self-serving. Look how important I am, so-and-so is my friend. I would regard it as a minor betrayal. And so there's a great deal that I could say this morning about my friendship with Al Martin, but I won't. I will say a good deal indirectly, but you're not really safe to assume that anything I say is necessarily reflective of our friendship. It may be, or it may not be. At certain points, you won't need to be a genius to work it out. As ministers, then, we need friends among our fellow pastors, men to whom we're committed and whom we love. What does such friendship look like? True, of course, of all friendships. We should have other friendships with other men. But we're thinking of ministerial friendships this morning. Let's move on then to five characteristics or benefits. They're both. First, I thought I'll do characteristics of ministerial friendship, and then I'll do the benefits of ministerial friendship. But then I realized that the characteristics are the benefits. The characteristics are the blessings. They are one and the same thing. Let me begin with closeness. Closeness. One of the key images of friendship in the scriptures, and it's a beautiful one, is the knitting together of two souls. Deuteronomy 13:6. Your friend who is as your own soul, sharing inmost thoughts and feelings, an intense emotional attachment. For Samuel 18, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. We read later in chapter 20 that they kissed one another and wept with one another. The knitting of souls, the closeness. Jesus and John embraced one another. Jesus wept at the grave of the man whom he called our friend, Lazarus. Paul could say of Onesimus, he is my very heart. Extravagant, emotional language, speaking of deep affection. And it's a tragedy that in our day, such language between men seems bizarre or perverted or worse. I was talking recently to a ministerial friend in Wales, and he spoke of two men in his congregation, elderly men now, Victorian gentlemen, single men of impeccable honour and godliness, upright men in every way, and they were friends. And they lived together in the same house. And my friend said, I am certain as I can be of anything, that never for one millisecond entered into the mind of either of them anything improper. They would have been aghast at the very thought. And yet, the whispering campaign started in the town where they were living. Why are these two men living together? What is going on here? It's a tragedy. And yet we can't hide behind that. I say this with some reluctance. We need to be more open, affectionate, and unguarded with each other. We need to be close to each other. I say that having shared the back seat of a car this morning to church with Robert Fisher and Bill Hughes, to my intense discomfort, and I couldn't get the door open quick enough to get out of the car. I think Pastor Hughes and I are starting to get to terms with hugging. I can't see kissing on the horizon. I ministered in Cyprus for some years, and of course the Greeks do kiss each other on the cheeks. It is the holy kiss of the New Testament. It's still there. It's an innocent thing. And I remember in the church in which I was serving, different from our own, they were ordaining deacons one day. And they had men deacons and women deacons. 3 men and 2 women. I was taking part in the service. And the 3 men and then the 2 girls. And of course we'd have to kiss them on the cheek afterwards. So the minister who was sharing with me in the service, who was a serious, very sober man, he whispered to me, "Ted, are you going to kiss the girls on the cheek?" "I don't think I will." I said, "It's only the hope of kissing the girls on the cheek that's going to enable me to get through kissing the men on the cheek." Something better coming. But that's a weakness in us. That is a weakness in us. Some of you will remember Gale Sayers, running back for the Chicago Bears in the late 60s. And Sayers had as his roommate another running back, a man called Brian Piccolo. And it was a time when a close friendship between a black man and a white man wasn't all that common in those days. And between 67 and 69, that friendship deepened and became a very real friendship between those two men. And then Piccolo developed cancer in 1969. And later that year, Gale Sayers was invited to New York to the professional football writers' banquet to receive the George Halas Award for the most courageous player in professional football. And Sayers came up to the front and everybody was clapping. And he stood there and he started to cry. And he said, "I tell you here and now, I accept this reward for Brian Piccolo. He's the man of courage who should receive it." And then he said, I love Brian Piccolo. Are there fellow pastors about whom you can say, "I love him. I love that man"? Are there fellow pastors to whom you can go and say, "I love you, brother. I love you"? Man, if you have no one you can say that to, you don't have a close friend. And you need a close friend. Closeness. Secondly, counsel. Pastors are in a dangerous position here because we are the people who give counsel. That is what we do. That is what we are for. Formally from the pulpit, or informally in our relationships with our people. We are the men who know the answers. We are the people who give advice. We don't get counsel, we dispense it. And that can make us arrogant, as if we have all the answers. It can leave us in our native foolishness, never getting the input of the wisdom of someone else. It can lead to embarrassing mistakes. And this is one of the great values of the input of a ministerial friend. Counsel. Proverbs 27:9. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. Especially when your friend is older than yourself, when he has a wider and deeper knowledge than you have, his counsel is precious. When he has a wealth of experience which you have not yet had, And he is able to draw on that wealth of experience to help you. And you're both involved in the same work. You have the same interests, the same difficulties. This gives added value to his counsel. He knows what he's talking about. And when he gives you counsel, it is sound. He can share with you what worked for him, what he found effective. He can tell you of his mistakes, so that you, by God's grace, can avoid those mistakes and be saved much anguish. When you're confronted by a problem which is unfamiliar to you, and you're unsure how to proceed, your friend's counsel can be a beacon of light to direct you. Very often, his counsel will seem blindingly obvious afterwards, but it isn't so at the time. I remember one instance that I can make reference to. Once I was beginning to get a little bit of a higher profile and my sermons were getting circulated, I started getting phone calls, mostly from the United States. How they got my phone number, I don't know. How these people can find you out, I don't know. But people were ringing me up asking for advice. All sorts of issues. Church issues, relationships with their pastors, personal issues. And the first two or three times, I suppose I was a bit flattered at this person coming from the ends of the earth to ask for my advice, and I would give the advice. But very soon, I became increasingly uneasy. I'm only hearing one side of the story. This is all very partial, it's very limited, and yet the phone calls kept coming. What was I to do? I called Pastor Martin. I laid the thing out. I said, in your experience, what do you do? He said, the first thing you say when they call you is, do you have a pastor of your own? Have you talked to him about this? If your pastor, having talked to you about this, would like to call me, I will be happy to talk to your pastor who is responsible for your soul. But I am not going to give you pastoral counsel. Well, I mean, it is blindingly obvious, isn't it? Of course that's what you should do. But it wasn't obvious to me at the time. And of course, once you say that, 99% of the calls stop. Because most of these people are cranks. If they're going to ring somebody up on the basis of listening to one sermon, contact somebody on the other side of the world about whom they know nothing. What does it tell you about? But a simple piece of practical, common sense advice. And I could have bumbled along, getting into all sorts of trouble for ages for the want of it. Now, his counsel may not always be welcome at first. I think I'll not give any personal examples of that. We may not always follow his counsel, and I certainly won't give any personal examples of that. But isn't that what the verse says in Proverbs? Iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another. That's not necessarily a gentle, smooth thing. There's a clash there. There are sparks flying. There are two edges bumping together. Charles Bridges. And I've resolved this past week, I'm going to read Charles Bridges on Proverbs. He's been sitting on my shelves for 30 years. To my shame, I've hardly ever looked at him, but he is so good. Bridges says, the collision of different minds whets each the edge of the other. Different perspective, a different view. And the iron sharpens iron. And it stimulates us and refreshes us. This counsel often develops into practical help. Your friend may be in a position to provide for you new opportunities of developing gifts. Your friend may have a wide range of contacts, wider than your own, and he may have sufficient confidence in you to recommend you to these contacts, so that through your friendship with him, wide doors of service are opened purely through his influence and recommendation. So that you will often say to yourself, if it wasn't for my friend, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be speaking in this church. I wouldn't be speaking at this conference. I owe it under God to his friendship that has brought this enriching to my life. What did Paul's friendship mean to Timothy, I wonder? Young Timothy expanded. He found things in himself he didn't know were there. Paul could see things that he himself would never have dared to see. I could say much. Thirdly, candor. This has been touched on already at the close of the previous hour, but it needs repeating. Another key biblical image of friendship is face to face. We're told in Exodus 33:11 that the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. Frank, open conversation. Eyeball to eyeball. Nothing hidden. No secret agenda. Confidences. Vulnerable to each other. Our souls naked to each other. With him, said God, referring to Moses in Numbers 12:8, with him I speak mouth to mouth. And in this friendship, nothing relevant is hidden. Note the word relevant. We don't pour everything out to our friends, even our best friends. There are things that are not to be poured out. There are things that are not to be shared. But everything relevant. Abraham was known in the scriptures as the friend of God. So we find the Lord in Genesis 18 saying, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do?" And he comes to his friend and he confides in him. Remember our Lord in John 15:5, "No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you." Brethren, how many face to face friendships do you have? Now, we're still sinful. And so a candid friend will from time to time point out our faults. He will even rebuke us. And we desperately need this as ministers. I really get annoyed when I hear ministers whining and complaining about the criticism that they receive in the ministry. Brethren, get real. We are incredibly cushioned and cosseted and surrounded by cotton wool. Our people in the workplace are having their work assessed daily. They are subjected to withering criticisms from their superiors. They are taken to pieces and put back together again. And then you've men who are pouting and falling to pieces if they hear one or two little critical remarks. Oh dear, poor me, what a hard time I'm having. We're surrounded by well-meaning flatterers. Godly people, good people who think far more highly of us than they ought to think. I say to my students, disregard 95% of the praise you get for your preaching. All it means is it's a kind, godly person who loves you and thinks you're a fine young man. It has really no relevance to the sermon you just preached. Don't start believing it. Proverbs says a man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. And we all love that, don't we? Don't we all have an appetite for the flatterer? Don't we all feel as we walk to the church door, we're waiting to hear it? So we need the astringent honesty of someone who loves us enough to tell us the truth about ourselves. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Although I love the realism of Proverbs 28:23, whoever rebukes a man will find more favour than he who flatters with his tongue. What word did I leave out? Afterwards. Whoever rebukes a man will afterwards find more favour than he who flatters with his tongue. Once we calm down, once we get over the initial hurt and annoyance with our friend who has rebuked us, once we come to ourselves again, we say, yes, he was a friend. Isn't that marvellous, the realism, the wisdom of the writer of Proverbs? Yes, it would be nice if it was immediately. But afterwards, you know who your friends are. I ask you, men, who do you have who will tell you unwelcome truths you need to hear? Well, we've got our wives, of course. My wife's a very gracious woman. But when she says to, when I ask her about the sermon, and she says, well, dear, it wasn't one of your best. I know it was a stinker. But we need friends like that. This candor also embraces the lighter side of friendship. We need times when we can relax, when we can let our hair down, when we can have fun, when we can play. Adults though we are, we need to play. Some men are too starchy and serious and pompous. And we ask ourselves, do they ever unbend? Do they ever play the fool? Wasn't it lovely to hear of Robert E. Lee having his toes tickled by his children? And we need this man to preserve our true humanity. Listen to W. Gordon Blakey. A real man obeying real forces, his very instincts will show him that man's nature was not designed to be constantly occupied with the most solemn and awful relations of things. That there are occasions in providence as well as moods of nature that seem to invite us to rejoicing and jubilant and even merry outpouring of soul. That's wise. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, one of the blessings of old friends is that you can afford to be stupid with them. Pastor Martin is exemplary in this regard. Oh, the book that will never be written. But it's what we need to be with people, and we are completely, completely relaxed. There are no daggers under their robes. They're not going to stab us in the back. Our guard is down. We're back to boyhood. Our restraints are gone. And we're free. If we want to talk nonsense, we can talk nonsense with our friends. The Victorian novelist George Eliot puts it this way. She writes, oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person. Having neither to weigh our thoughts or measure our words, but pouring them all out just as they are, chaff and grain together. Certain that a faithful hand will take and sift them. Keep what is worth keeping. And with a breath of kindness, blow the rest away. Not great. We need it. And friends, the pastor who never does this, there'll be something inhuman about him. There'll be something intimidating. There'll be hard. He'd be machine-like. And the pastor who can relax like this, will find that his words, when they are serious, will be all the more witty when they need to be, and they will be infused with a compelling human warmth. Candor. Fourthly, courtesy. Courtesy. It's an old-fashioned word. But in the intimacy, in the robust give and take of close friendship, where no holds are barred and there are no secrets, there has to be, at the same time, a balancing tact, a delicacy, a gentlemanly-like spirit, a sensitivity not to invade those areas of our friend's privacy which are inviolable, not to trade on his affection, respecting his feelings, allowing him space. It's essential for the dignity of the individual. We can no longer in our fallen state be completely naked with each other. There has to be a covering. And to remove that covering is actually the quickest way to destroy friendship. Proverbs in many ways encourages us to this sensitivity, this tact. In 25:17, we're told not to outstay our welcome. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbour's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you. And we take these as sort of semi-facetious and we smile at them, but this is a serious point. There are times when enough is enough. There are times when our friends need to be alone. There are times when we're in danger of being clingy and invasive, and we have to step back. And we have to know those times. And they have to know it with us. We shouldn't be chillingly out of place with our friend's mood. Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day. You've seen that. People, good-hearted, but they've a hide like a rhinoceros. They've absolutely no concept of where their friend is, what's going on in their lives, and their behaviour is jarringly, chillingly inappropriate. Whoever blesses his neighbour with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. There's always a teasing element in close friendship. I'm sorry for the man who is never teased, whose children don't tease him. There's something wrong there in his fatherhood. Whose wife can't tease him. Whose friends can't tease him. And yet, and I speak as a serial offender, the teasing can go too far. It can just go over the edge. It can slip into something that is actually hurtful and cruel, unless we're very careful. Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbour and says, "I was only joking." Bridges comments, "How little does a thoughtless man consider the misery which his love of mischief causes to others." I know a middle-aged man in the ministry, and he's single. And that man is teased mercilessly and endlessly. And I happen to know that he loved a woman with all his heart, and I think still loves her. And she married someone else. And that is the easy, cheap butt of every joke. So-and-so's not married yet, and everybody roars with laughter. How does he feel when he goes home at night? Again, when we're rebuking a friend, this gentle courtesy is vital. The Chinese have a proverb: do not use a hatchet to remove a fly from your friend's forehead. It's good advice. I remember one time when Pastor Martin was coming to preach at my own congregation, and there was a little bit of our church order that I knew he wouldn't agree with and wouldn't particularly like. And the temptation came on me to change it for the day, just when he was there. And then I thought, now, Donnelly, don't be a wimp. You're doing it with a good conscience. You're doing it before God. Behave in your church as you always do. And he came and he preached. And that was nearly 20 years ago. And never to this day has he mentioned it, or never have I mentioned it. He wouldn't want to hurt my feelings. He wouldn't want to hurt my feelings. People have said, you and Al Martin, how do you get on discussing baptism? Subjects of baptism. We've never mentioned it once. I don't think we've ever mentioned it once. In all the hundreds of hours we've spent together. There's a delicacy. There's a restraint in friendship. There are areas of strong conviction. And it's part of safeguarding the dignity of your friend. Courtesy. And then constancy. One of the saddest features in friendship is friends who prove false. The strongest Old Testament term for friend is the word aluf, which means a guide or a bosom companion. And it's often used, most often used, in the context of betrayal or estrangement. Close friends, bosom friends, who prove false. It's telling us that friendship is fragile. It needs guarding. We're told in Proverbs 2:17 that the adulteress forsakes the companion of her youth, the bosom friend of her youth. The whisperer separates close friends. I've been blessed in that. I have never been betrayed by a really close friend. I've never been estranged from a really close friend. I have never myself, to my knowledge, betrayed a close friend. But better men than I have had that experience. You remember the agony of David in Psalm 55. It is not an enemy who taunts me. Then I could bear it. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend. It is you. Some of you men have come to that point in your life when with grief and surprise you've said, it's you. It's you. The bedrock of true friendship is steadfast loyalty. Shame. Shame on pastors who break friendship, who get pouty and sensitive and can't be reconciled. Their people know it. What's it saying? What's it saying? Do not forsake your friend. A friend loves at all times. And a brother is born for adversity. Shakespeare says in Hamlet, those friends thou hast, and their adoption tried, grapple them to thy soul with hoops of steel. My friends, we live in a fickle, two-faced world. We have to show a steadfast friendship. God says in his sovereignty to you and me, you can't stop me loving you. I've decided to love you. I've determined to love you. And nothing you can do can stop me loving you. Are you willing to say that to your brothers in Christ? Nothing you can do will stop you loving me. If you hurt me, I'll forgive you. If I still think you're wrong, I'll leave it with the Lord. To his own master, he stands or falls. But I'm going to link arms with you, and I'm not going to break it. There is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. It is Christ-like. It can be very costly to maintain this friendship. Sometimes it involves standing up for your friend when he is not present to defend himself. Don't you love that moment in 1 Samuel 20 when everybody's getting on David's case in the court and the poisonous criticism is going and Saul's angry at David and he's trying to poison his son against his friend, and we read that Jonathan stood up and answered Saul, his father, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" And Saul hurled a spear at him to strike him. He stood up for his friend when nobody else would. I still remember an evening in England where a group of us were meeting together. It was a most pleasant social evening. And in the course of the evening, someone made a stupid, unfair criticism about one of my friends, who's not a million miles from here, and his church, and all his doings. And everybody started joining in. And I sat and took it for a while. And then suddenly, that happy little social gathering of cultured, civilized people had a raging Old Testament prophet in their midst. Glaring eyes, wagging the finger. "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Have you checked these things out? Do you know they're true? I know they're not true. I've been there. Every idle word that men speak, they'll give account in the day of judgment." Never did a social evening collapse more comprehensively and completely. I felt sorry for the hosts who were guiltless in the whole thing. The whole evening just descended. And in the car on the way home, Lorna rather wistfully said, "I suppose you had to say those things." Well, would you say them? If they're firing bullets at your friend, they're going to go through my body before they hit him. Would you take a bullet for him? What sort of a friend would you be if you sat there, silent? Or worse,